I'm Artie Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Last month, 22 people were killed and dozens more wounded at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, a few days after two Walmart employees were killed at a store in Mississippi. This week, the CEO of Walmart, Doug McMillon, announced the company would stop selling ammunition for handguns and for military assault-style weapons, would no longer sell handguns at its Alaska stores. It had already stopped those sales in all other states, and would discourage its customers from openly carrying firearms while shopping at the retailer. As expected, organizations like Every Town for Gun Safety hailed the decision, while the NRA called it shameful for, quote, succumbing to the pressure of the anti-gun elites. Interestingly, the CEO faced pressure from his own employees who called on their boss to take a stance against guns and gun violence. We asked Michael Corkery to join us. He's a reporter at the New York Times who covers business. And Michael, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
So what's the significance of this decision? And I should just also add, we're talking about the world's largest retailer, certainly the largest retailer here in the United States, with something like 1.5 million employees. What's the significance of what Walmart did?
I think it's of huge symbolic significance. I mean, like you mentioned, Walmart is it's a massive company. It has stores within that touch, you know, that serve 90% of the U.S. population. It's the largest private employer, 1.5 million people, like you mentioned. It's a huge cross section of America that it touches and that come through its doors each day. Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals. So in the past, Walmart has, you know, because of that, has pretty much shied away from wading into any political debates. Even the gun debate, even previous to this decision this week, Walmart's been scaling back its gun business, but it's been doing it very quietly. This is the first time that Walmart has made a move to limit gun sales and also called on Congress and the administration to strengthen background checks and to revive debate about an assault rifle ban. This is uncharacteristic of Walmart, and it says a lot about what's happened at the company, given that its store was the place of a mass shooting. And also, I think it shows where Walmart sees the country moving on the gun issue.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. I mean, it should be said we're talking about, you know, 24 people being killed, dozens being wounded at two Walmart stores last month. So clearly, this was a problem that did need to be addressed. But I'm curious about McMillon himself. What can you tell us about him?
So Doug McMillon is a lifer, a Walmart lifer. I mean, he's grew up in Arkansas, where Walmart is headquartered. He started working at Walmart in high school, you know, went away to college, then to business school, started out in the warehouse, became CEO in 2014. He has sort of helped Walmart evolve, from a company that was, mainly seen as kind of, a ruthless capitalist machine. You know, it was all about low cost. It was all about, paying its workers low wages. It was to many in America, it was seen as sort of the worst of capitalism. He has started to try to soften that image and make it more of a corporately responsible company. This is his first big statement on guns, but it's not his first political statement. He, in 2017, after the riots in Charlottesville, Virginia, he was the first CEO to really forcefully come out and call on Donald Trump to decry the racism in that event. And it was a big deal. Other CEOs followed, but he was the first one to kind of really do it in a forceful way. So this is, he's a unique and interesting CEO for this huge company.
Well, and it's interesting, and I don't know how unusual, that employees did sign a petition essentially asking the company to do more to protect probably themselves to some degree, but also the country from gun violence. Was that unusual for employees at Walmart to step up that way?
Well, it is. I mean, there's no unions at Walmart, famously. I mean, it's a very anti-union company. So, you know, if you speak up at a place like that, your job can be in jeopardy. So that was a big deal. Now, you know, for these workers to sort of take a stand and be willing to maybe risk backlash, the company assured that there would be none. But still, you never know. Nonetheless, you know, Walmart did point out, and I think they, you know, have a point that got attention, the petition that for people that were saying, you know, you need to protect us, the workers, you need to protect us and you need to protect the country and do something. That petition effort got media attention. What didn't get media attention was workers within Walmart saying, we're upset also about what happened in El Paso, but we believe in gun rights. Don't go too far the other way. Again, reflecting that Walmart is a big place and it's got employees and customers with a wide range of opinions. And I think that just underscores how significant this thing was that Walmart did, was to take a stand forcefully in one direction instead of, you know, because in so many ways it has to straddle all sides of the political spectrum, and it really came down strong on one side.
I'm looking at what Doug McMillan wrote, and he ends by saying, we encourage our nation's leaders to move forward and strengthen background checks and to remove weapons from those who have been determined to pose an imminent danger. Do you think, Michael, that this very public statement from the head of the head of Walmart, is going to have some kind of impact on Congress and the White House in Washington?
I don't know. I mean, again, I think already opinion polls have shown that a lot of the American public, the majority, supports a lot of these measures already. And in some ways, you know, as the CEO of the largest company, he is giving voice to that. It's another very powerful voice to those opinions. But as you know, those that have followed this gun debate know, you know, they're the special interests that of gun rights that seem to have a lot of sway, even despite some of the popular opinion saying that there's a need for more limits, there's a need for stronger background checks, and something, you know, some way of dealing with these assault rifles.
Do you think Walmart will, quote unquote, pay a price? And by that, I mean there might be boycotts from people who are more allied with the NRA. But then on the other hand, as you say, public opinion, if most people support what Walmart seems to be doing, maybe they would go shop there.
I think you're right. I think probably Walmart's going to benefit from this, and it will anger many, it already has angered many of its customers. But Walmart's growth and their strategy to grow is not in parts of the country where gun rights are very popular. It already dominates much of the retail industry in rural America, where Walmart is growing and wants to keep growing is in along the East Coast, in cities, in middle-class suburbs, where views on guns tend to be more liberal. And I think this is going to improve its standing in places like that, which is important to its overall business.
So in certain ways, a business decision coming from Walmart?
It's part of it. I mean, I don't by saying, you know, by pointing that out, I don't mean to belittle or de-emphasize just how this shook, what happened in El Paso shook Walmart and shook its leadership, shook its rank and file workers. I mean, you know, I spoke to some of the employees in that store that, you know, like now so many school teachers, school principals, people in synagogues, churches have had to deal with mass shooters and the horror of one day you're at work, you know, selling stuff, and then the next you're, you know, seeing this carnage and dealing with it and trying to save lives. It profoundly shook Walmart. And I think that is a large part of why Walmart came out so forcefully for gun limitations. Nonetheless, this does fit and does kind of align with its broader business interests also to start moving in the direction of supporting and limiting, you know, gun gun sales, certainly, which are not a big part of its business overall, and also kind of being on the side of gun restrictions broadly in the national debate.
Do you think it'll be tough to carry out what Walmart wants its customers to do, which is to not openly carry firearms while they are shopping at their stores? Do you think that will be a tough thing for, I don't know, employees, security at the Walmart to essentially enforce?
Yeah, that particular part of what Walmart did, in addition to, you know, limit very concrete steps of getting all the ammunition out that might be used in an assault rifle, getting all that out of its stores and phasing that out, it's very concrete, strong statements, you know, on supporting stronger background checks. The thing about the way that they've this open carry issue, the way that they phrased it, was that they respectfully request that customers.
I noticed that.
And they're very careful, not to say that it was a ban. And when pushed, I said, please, are you prohibiting? And they were like, no, absolutely not. We're not prohibiting people from carrying guns in openly into our stores. We're just asking them not to, which is vague. And although gun control advocates see it as a victory for Walmart to even sort of, you know, come out and say they don't want their customers to do this. But I think it's a real question how that's practically going to be carried out, this new policy, because open carry is a lightning rod. And it's many gun rights folks will use this most likely as a way to sort of test their rights. And again, there's no ban. So that will be a really interesting thing to see how that plays out. And we just saw yesterday these follow-ons by Wegmans, the grocery chain, Walgreens, CVS, said, we also respectfully request that our customers don't bring guns openly into our stores. But again, they're not prohibiting them.
Michael, final question. We have about a minute here. And you mentioned that Walmart is looking to move into more urban neighborhoods, even suburban neighborhoods, more quote-unquote liberal or perhaps blue neighborhoods. Also, as you have written in the New York Times, getting into the e-commerce business and trying to give Amazon a run for their money, how much do you think this is sort of factoring into their decision?
Well, again, I think they're evolving as a company and where they're going to grow their customer base, and they're locked in a dogfight with Amazon, and I think anything they can do to sort of distinguish themselves in the minds of customers as a place people want to shop. Look, everybody now, you know, Walmart, Amazon, they all offer 2-day, 1-day shipping. I mean, you know, there's no distinction. They're not going to win on getting people their things quicker. And so I think, you know, they're thinking, and I think this is right, that people want to shop in a place where they feel good about shopping. And if the choice is online between Amazon and Walmart, and you can get the same thing at both, and you say, hey, I like what Walmart does on guns, well, then that is going to help distinguish you.
Well, that is where we have to end our conversation. Michael Corky, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a reporter at the New York Times who covers business. Cynthia emails, I applaud Walmart for finally taking a stance on guns. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Just a recap here, after a mass shooting at an El Paso, Texas Walmart and the murder of two Walmart employees at a store in Mississippi, the CEO of the company announced this week the retailer would stop selling handguns at all its stores, ammunition for handguns, and for assault-style firearms. Walmart is the largest retailer in the country, frankly in the world, and its decision is big news. Now, the House of Representatives passed legislation earlier this year to increase background checks for gun sales, which has been languishing in the Senate. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell dropped the issue in President Trump's lap, saying he should decide about gun violence legislation. Meanwhile, parents are buying their children bulletproof backpacks, and students are undergoing training about what to do if a shooter enters their school. And according to the Gun Violence Archive, to date this year, There have been 38,447 gun violence incidents, including 291 mass shootings, resulting in 10,149 deaths and 20,291 injuries. So what programs and policies are effective? We asked Cassandra Kerfasi to join us. She is the Deputy Director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Cassandra, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Michael Siegel. He's a physician and researcher in the Department of Community Health Sciences at Boston University School of Public Health. And Michael Siegel, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines always open, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know about what kind of policies and programs that you think will be effective. Let me start with Walmart. And Cassandra, I'll start with you. I don't want to spend the whole hour talking about Walmart, but what do you make of its decision, the significance of its decision?
I think large corporations across the U.S., including Walmart, have recognized that they have a role in providing access to firearms through their sale, both of the firearms and the ammunition. And when a tragedy like the shooting in El Paso has happened, these corporations have recognized that maybe they need to reevaluate their role for one way or the other. They're recognizing that perhaps they want to do something differently.
And I noticed that Kroger followed suit just several hours after the announcement from the head of Walmart. Michael Siegel, how do you see this decision?
Well, I think that there is strong evidence that the density of outlets is related to gun crime rates. So anything that's done that makes it more difficult to access, you know, guns or ammunition is going to have some effect on the gun crime rate. So I think that, you know, in a sense, in public health, we try to limit products that are harmful to certain stores that are specialized in those products. For alcohol, you know, we know that when they're just sold by alcohol stores, when tobacco is just sold by tobacco stores, there's less access to it, and it makes a difference. So I think eliminating gun sales from some of these large chains voluntarily will actually make a difference.
Cassandra, let me go back to you, and I've lost count of how many shows we've done about gun violence and what to do about it. Is it possible to have a different kind of conversation that might get us to some kind of resolution or even consensus? About a third of households have a gun in this country. I know you're a gun owner and a gun user as well. Is there a way to reframe this conversation that's going to be more productive?
I think the focus in these conversations really needs to be about safety and responsibility. So those are two things that tend to resonate with folks. And there's this sort of misperception that no one agrees on any of these policies. But we know from a range of public opinion polls that the vast majority of U.S. adults, including gun owners and non-gun owners, support background checks. They support requiring handgun purchasers to buy licenses. They support extreme risk protection laws. So there's a broad range of effective solutions that we know have broad support, and we really need to be focused on safety and responsibility as the core to drive that conversation forward.
Michael, is this a political problem in that, and I'm thinking actually after the massacre at that elementary school in Connecticut, when it seemed if there was a reason to do something about the problem of gun violence, that would have been it, but nothing happened.
Well, I think that Cassandra is exactly right. This is not actually as controversial an issue as it's made out to be. The reality is that the overwhelming majority of the public supports mm-hmm. Background checks, supports extreme risk protection orders. Everybody seems to agree on the principle here. Even the NRA, in its statements, agrees that people who have a history of violence should not have access to guns. People who have a criminal history shouldn't have guns. And so all these laws are doing is basically helping to enforce that by making sure that we're checking to see whether someone has a criminal history. There's no point in having a prohibitor saying you're not allowed to have a gun if you have a criminal history, if we're not actually checking to see if people have a criminal history. So I think there's a lot of common ground that everybody agrees on, and it's just a question of enforcing the intent of what everybody seems to agree makes sense.
But picking up on that, you're saying this is more an enforcement problem than, let's say, reinstating the assault weapons ban?
No, it's a law problem. In other words, we need to have policies that allow us to follow through on the intent. So, for example, when Congress passed the background check law in the first place, the whole point of that was to make sure that anyone who buys a gun doesn't have a criminal history or other prohibitive history. So if you're not doing background checks on every gun sale, then you're not fulfilling the intent of that law. And the bill that's being debated in Congress now that the House passed, all it would do is to really enforce the intent of the original law. 22% of sales of guns are taking place from private sellers without a background check. And all this law is saying is, let's make that zero, because that was the intent of the original law.
Cassandra, so is this a political problem in that that's what the House passed? Mitch McConnell doesn't want to bring it up. And if he doesn't want to bring it up, it's not going to move in the Senate. And it's not going to become law.
I think one of the issues we have is, again, the disconnect between what we know from a range of surveys is this broad public support, 90% or more of U.S. adults. But for some reason, that's not translating into pressure in the Senate. And I think one of the issues driving that is for years, folks who have been advocating for expanded gun rights have been single-issue voters on guns. That's what they go to the polls for. I think we're starting to hear some of that transitioning to the other side, where folks are single-issue voters in support of reasonable gun policy and gun safety. We're hearing more and more candidates coming out openly and proudly in support of these gun policies. There's been this perception that if you come out for gun safety, you're going to lose your election. But actually, in the 2018 election cycle, many folks who had a downgraded NRA record or came out sort of with an F rating at the time that they were a candidate, they were successful in their election. So I think hopefully some of that tide will start to turn, and our elected officials will feel some of that pressure from the public.
Cassandra, we know there are problems at the NRA, a lot of infighting there. Do you think the NRA has lost some of its punch?
I think at the end of the day, we have a broad group of folks, partly these young individuals from March for Our Lives, who are really motivated at keeping gun violence in the conversation and really leading some of these efforts. And we have gun safety and gun policy organizations who are supporting candidates who are really advancing or wanting to advance reasonable and evidence-based policies. So I really hope that folks show up and vote, and that our elected officials begin to listen to what is being said in these broad support for this policy.
As I said, we've had some comments here. Kate says, everyone talks about the Second Amendment right to guns, but what about the right to feel safe living in our everyday lives? An email from Cindy, I'm a member of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Lots of our members are gun owners like my family, and we support the Second Amendment and common sense gun laws. And I think in certain ways, that's what I want to try to get at, because I know that most people, Michael, who have and own and use guns for either hunting or for target shooting, wants some kind of sensible laws.
I think that there is this feeling that the idea of preventing gun violence and protecting gun rights are mutually exclusive. It's been portrayed, and the NRA has done a great job of doing this, of portraying it this way, as a choice. It's an either or. It's either we decide to have laws that reduce gun violence, or we protect gun rights. And I don't think that's the case at all. In fact, I think that we can do both. We can have laws that prevent gun violence at the same time not interfering and, in fact, protecting people's gun rights. I think the policies that will try to keep guns out of the hands of people who have criminal history make sense, that they're not interfering with gun rights. And ironically, the greatest threat to gun rights right now is the NRA. And the reason I say that is that they are basically saying that anyone with a mental health history they're pinning this all on mental health, and they want people with a mental health history not to have guns. And that really would interfere with gun rights, because then there are a lot of people with mental health issues who are not at increased risk at all. And so that really would take people's gun rights away. And I think the way to protect gun rights is to make sure that people who are at high risk for violence don't have access to guns.
Let me just reintroduce the two of you. That's Michael Siegel. He's a physician, also a researcher in the Department of Community Health Sciences at the Boston University School of Public Health. Also with us is Cassandra Crafasi, and she's the deputy director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And we are talking about the problem of gun violence in this country and the policies, the programs that have proved effective. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Michael, let me go back to you. Is it more important who has the guns or what kind of gun they have? And I ask that, should we focus on ensuring people that should not have guns to make sure they don't get that guns, or should we ban certain guns to make sure that they don't get into those people's hands?
Well, we've actually done research that tried to answer that exact question. We looked at a wide range of laws, laws that restrict the types of guns that are allowed and laws that restrict who can have access to those guns. And we found that by and large, when you're talking about overall rates of firearm homicide, laws that regulate who has access to the guns are far more effective. You know, the problem with the idea of an assault weapon ban is that how do you define an assault weapon? Yeah. And typically they're defined based on cosmetic features that don't actually affect the firing rate of the gun at all. And so I think that the focus, if we really want to have a large impact, I think the focus needs to be on a small set of laws that working together actually can reduce, we found, homicide rates by 35%. And that is a combination of having background checks, permit requirements for guns, and not allowing people with any kind of violent history to have access to them.
Cassandra, I'll be curious about what you say in response to Michael's answer to my question, but also how you see the assault weapon ban. It ran out a number of years ago, about 15 years ago, but should it be reinstated?
Michael points about we need a street law.
You know what, Cassandra, we're going to call you back, and I apologize. It's just a really bad phone line that we have with you. We want to make sure that people can understand what you have to say. Let me go back to you, Michael, before we get Cassandra back on the line. So if we're focusing on who has guns, the people at risk tend to be who? I mean, if we're going to focus on those who people, but we don't want to throw mental health issues into the mix here, how do we decide who can and can't have a gun?
Well, by far, the greatest risk factor for violence is a history of violence. And what we need to do is to make sure that people who have a history of violence or threatened violence can't access a gun. And we need to do that by, number one, having laws that basically say that if you have a violent history, you can't have a gun. Number two, by checking every sale to make sure that someone doesn't have that history. And number three, by making sure that we give law enforcement officers discretion to be able to deny concealed carry permits to people who do have a history of violence. And I think one of the major loopholes in addition to the background check loophole, second loophole in our federal law, is that you're only prohibited from having a gun if you commit a felony, a violent felony. If it's just a misdemeanor, you can still own a gun. And I think that's a problem.
And this has to do with things like domestic violence as well, right? Red flag laws.
Well, even with domestic violence, there is a loophole, because if you are subject to a restraining order or have committed a domestic violence crime, if it was a dating partner, according to federal law, you can still own a gun. And so that's another loophole that needs to be closed here.
I think we have you back, Cassandra. And my question to you was just where you stand on assault weapons and the thought of banning them once again.
So I think one of the core issues of the original assault weapons ban, as Michael alluded to, was that it was based on features of the firearms. And it was so easy for manufacturers to make simple modifications that could then be created as aftermarket accessories and purchased and then installed by that gun owner on the firearm. I think what we need to be thinking about is, again, think about high-risk individuals who may be at risk of harming themselves or others, and really focused in on making sure those individuals don't obtain any kind of firearm. And if we do want to think about assault-style rifles, focusing on maybe having higher criteria to obtain semi-automatic rifles.
Hmm. Like what? What kind of criteria?
So, for example, if I want to drive a car, I get a driver's license, right? I take my written exam, I take my driving test, and I can drive a car. But that does not allow me to drive a motorcycle or a big rig, right? I need to get additional training, and I need to take an additional test in order to get a license to drive those kinds of cars. And I think we could take a lesson from that and apply the same strategy to different kinds of firearms that may have increased lethality due to the pace at which they fire or the number of rounds they can hold. Just thinking about taking these lessons from motor vehicle safety and applying them to firearm safety.
Interestingly, Maria says if we take out insurance on cars, why don't we take out insurance on guns? And we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about what can actually prevent gun violence, also allow law-abiding gun owners to be able to keep their firearms, talking with Cassandra Carfassi, and she's deputy director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Also with us, Michael Siegel. He's a physician and researcher in the Department of Community Health Sciences at the Boston University School of Public Health. We want to hear from you, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's listen to Bob Vaiden III. He's the son of the owner of Bob's Little Sports Shop. It's in Glassboro, New Jersey. And here he is talking to WHYY reporter Nick Pugliese.
The AR-type guns, that's what's in the news right now. You know, all these nut guys that are going out and doing all these mass shootings, that's what they're gravitating to, so that's what the public sees, so that's where the pressure is on everybody to ban them. When reality, if they had some of these other hunting rifles, they could be actually more dangerous. But it's all public perception, and then that public perception, you know, just moves on from there.
Do you agree with that, Michael Siegel?
Actually, I think that is a very good point. I think that, you know, there, it really doesn't necessarily matter what the features of a gun are in terms of the cosmetic features. You can have a pistol, and if it's equipped with a 100-round magazine, you can do an incredible amount of damage in a short amount of time. What I think a lot of people don't realize is that there is no difference in the firing rate for any semi-automatic gun. They all fire at the exact same rate. I think what is important, though, is the magazine capacity, because you are limited in your shooting speed by when you have to reload the gun. And in a mass shooting situation, having, you know, even though it only takes a few seconds to change the magazine, that can be enough, and it can make a big difference in terms of giving time for people to flee or for there to be an intervention. And so I think the focus should be on not the gun, but in terms of reducing casualties from mass shootings, it should be on the ammunition and the magazine size specifically.
Cassandra, let me go back to you and actually let me read a tweet from the governor of Texas. This is Greg Abbott, and he's talking about the Odessa, Texas shooter. And he tweeted, not only did the Odessa gunman have a criminal history, he also previously failed a gun purchase background check in Texas, and he didn't go through a background check for the gun he used in Odessa. We must keep guns out of criminals' hands. And I think in certain ways, the NRA and others who are, you know, pretty unwavering in the Second Amendment are saying, you know, we need an example of someone who's basically sort of did a workaround when it came to background checks. And it seems like this might be a case.
Correct. Under federal law, we currently have two ways to get a firearm. If you choose to, you can go to a federally licensed dealer, undergo a background check, and make sure you're not prohibited, and get that gun. If you don't want to do that, if you're prohibited or you otherwise don't want your name associated with that sale, under federal law, it's perfectly legal for you to meet someone online and connect or go to a gun show and get that gun without the same background check that would be required if you bought from a licensed dealer. And so we've created this loophole under federal law, which some states have chosen to fill. But one point I want to make sure to highlight is that having a mental illness or a mental health issue, mm-hmm. while it may in very, very small ways increase risk of violence, it actually is far more likely to lead to an individual being a victim of violence. And if we were to eliminate all interpersonal violence that was caused by someone who had a mental health issue, it would be less than 5% of all violence. And so I think it's, while we need to be focused on a robust mental health system to get people the help they need, it's really a tool to distract from our gun violence issue when we focus on mental health instead of access to firearms.
I mean, Michael, it seems that this is a uniquely American problem, this gun violence problem.
Well, it is, because there's no other country where there is the volume of guns that we have, and most other countries have regulations that are more strict in terms of making sure that guns are not in the hands of people who shouldn't own them.
Let me read a comment from Sam. He says, regarding, quote, may issue permits, the Second Amendment is still a right, and issuing permits on a, quote, needs basis is a terrible way to exercise that right. Michael, can you take that in? And then, Cassandra, I'll get you in on this as well.
So, you know, what the commenter is talking about is that in some states, they have a may issue law, which basically means that the police have discretion in denying a permit, a concealed carry permit, to an applicant if they have reason to believe that the person should not have one. And in some of the statutes, it's written in such a strict way that the person actually has to prove that they have a need for the weapon. I think the main point about these laws is not the need for somebody to prove they need the weapon, but the fact that the police need to have discretion, because they may know that someone has a violent history or someone is at risk for violence. And if they're not able to deny a gun in that situation, then they're essentially letting someone own a gun who they know is going to be a threat. And that doesn't make any sense at all.
How do you see it, Cassandra?
So I think a key element that's important to keep in mind is that currently the Second Amendment only applies to gun ownership in the home. The Second Amendment does not guarantee an individual the right to carry a gun in public. There's the New York and Supreme Court case that may change that interpretation. But I do think, to Michael's point about discretion, there are often individuals who may appear lawful on paper, but may have had multiple calls for service by police for domestic violence or other issues that make them sort of lawful but dangerous. And it's really important that law enforcement has the ability to decide whether they want those individuals carrying loaded concealed firearms in their communities.
Let me go back to some research that you did, Michael, and this having, I'm quoting here an interview that you was conducted with you. In large cities with more than 100,000 people, we found background checks were even more effective at reducing rates of gun-related deaths than they were in suburban or rural areas. In contrast, we found that violent misdemeanor laws were more effective in reducing homicide rates in suburban and rural areas than they were in large cities. Help us understand the difference there.
Well, you know, the study that you're talking about, we tried to look at to see whether there are differences in the effectiveness of state firearm laws in different types of areas. And the main finding is that there are. And we can't exactly explain the reasons for this at this point. But I think what's important, the overall takeaway from this research, is that we need to have a package of laws in order to really be effective and to cover all situations. We need to have a package of laws. And the package of laws that we found are most effective are laws that, number one, set the prohibitors, basically saying you can't have a gun if you have a violent history. And number two, enforce that by conducting background checks, by requiring permits, and by making sure the police have discretion. Interestingly, in that study, I'll just add that the one law that we found did have an effect both in urban and non-urban areas was a requirement for permits. Huh. And I think that having a permit system enables a state to do background checks and also to use its own data. You know, the federal database is only as good as the information that's put into it. And sometimes the state has information that the federal government doesn't have. And the permit system allows the state to use its own data in making sure that a person is appropriate to own a gun.
Cassandra, we've been talking about gun violence and the numbers of people injured and dying because of gun violence. And we haven't, you referenced it very vaguely, but we haven't really talked about suicide and gun violence. And that's such a significant, but I have to say, overlooked part of this conversation.
Absolutely. When you look at the distribution of firearm deaths in the U.S., over half are the result of suicide. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the challenges is that it doesn't get the media coverage that homicide or in particular mass shootings get. Part of it has to do with stigma. There's a lot of sometimes shame or other sort of stigma associated with having a suicide in the household. And I think that can drive some of the lack of discussion or lack of recognition as of suicide as a problem, particularly with regard to firearms. But there have been, I think, two really important things happening over the last few years to address that. So one, the National Shooting Sports Foundation has partnered up with gun dealers across the country with the Gun Shop Project to help gun dealers recognize signs of someone who may be suicidal when they come into their shop, try to help reduce access to those individuals during that time of crisis. And another, in the state of Utah, folks have been working with people who do trainings for concealed carry permits, for example, and working suicide into that curriculum as a way to raise this conversation that you know, just because you may sort of be depressed, that doesn't mean you shouldn't own a firearm, but maybe you shouldn't have easy access to it during that time of crisis. Maybe you store it off site or you have a friend hang on to it. And I think it's been really heartening for me to see a shift in some of the conversation around firearms design.
Well, and I think, too, Michael raises the question about just responsible ownership, making sure that guns are locked, that they're not lying around a house with, you know, with ammunition inside where, you know, someone who might be depressed or children could get their hands on a firearm.
The, you know, a study that we published recently found that the youth suicide rate in a state is best predicted by the prevalence of household gun ownership in that state, not by the actual number of youth who are depressed or suicidal, feeling suicidal. And that's really interesting because what it suggests is that access to a lethal means, we know that the use of a gun, the number of actual suicides that occur is much greater than when something other than a gun is used. And so reducing access for youth to a gun is going to have a huge impact on the youth suicide rate. And that's why the idea of safe storage is incredibly important Gun owners just might not think about that. It's not the first thing they think of, that, oh my gosh, you know, possibly my child is going to get access to a gun and use it. I mean, that's not in their mind. So I think programs that educate gun owners and that work with them and with gun dealers to promote this idea is important.
Here's a question from Steve. Cassandra, I'll put this to you. Steve asks, is there a way to trace guns to someone in the same way that you can trace tasers? Is there a way of knowing which gun belongs to which person?
So under federal law, any firearm has to have a serial number on it, and that serial number can be used to trace the gun back to the original purchaser. The challenge is in the vast majority of states, that record keeping is only required for the first sale. So once a gun is sold in a private transfer, we have no way of tracking it through its lifeline and maybe if it makes it into crime. And the other concern is increasingly we're hearing about 3D printed guns, which are guns that you can make with a 3D printer, which don't have a serial number, or what are sometimes referred to as like nearly complete or ghost guns that are less than 80% complete that you can buy online and machine shop out. And again, you have a functioning firearm that has no serial number and no way to trace it back. So in theory, yes, for the most part, but we have record keeping issues and then perhaps a growing concern about these untraceable firearms.
Judy has a question. I thought that no federal funds could be used for gun safety research. How are your guests being funded in their research, Michael?
So it's fortunately that was overturned. The federal government now can fund gun research. Whether it does or not is a different question. And so far, not a lot of federal funding has been spent on this. One of the major issues in terms of the funding is the fact that the Dickey Amendment, which was passed in, I think, 1996, has been interpreted by CDC to mean that they can't do gun research. And it's actually not true. It simply says they can't do research that promotes gun control. But most of the research that is done or is needed is not promoting gun control. It's basically just finding out what's going to work. And so there's a lot that the CDC can do right now. And I think that, that amendment just needs to be taken off the books. There's really no reason for it.
Let me read one more comment. This is from James, and James says, I think we need to dispel the argument that a good guy with a gun can stop a bad guy with a gun. He says, a few weeks ago in North Philadelphia, we saw a bad guy with a gun hold off an entire Philadelphia Police Department for hours. And this is a story that got some national play there. But any thoughts from you, Cassandra?
I think there has been an idea promoted largely by the NRA and other gun rights groups that carrying a firearm will magically make you capable of intervening in all sorts of dangerous or threatening situations. And the truth of the matter is, while there are some folks who can successfully use a firearm in self-defense, having a firearm increases your risk of self-harm and harm, sort of injury risk within your home. The likelihood that someone is going to successfully use it sort of as a good guy is very low because in a crisis situation, we know even law enforcement who are thoroughly trained have a hard time sort of engaging and stopping these quote-unquote bad guys, as was evidenced in Philadelphia. So yeah. I think it's sort of this myth that's been promulgated by folks promoting gun rights with really not a lot of evidence to back it up.
Michael, we're almost out of time here. Any final thoughts from you, 15 seconds or less?
I guess I would just emphasize that, this is not an issue of stopping gun violence or preventing gun violence versus protecting gun rights. We can actually do both at the same time. And, I think that we can actually enhance gun rights, because I think that if we work harder to keep guns out of the hands of people who have a history of violence and shouldn't have guns, we can actually better protect the rights of law-abiding citizens to get guns in an easier way.
Well, I appreciate you both joining us today in Radio Times. Michael Siegel, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And he's a physician. He's also a researcher in the Department of Community Health Sciences at the Boston University School of Public Health. Cassandra Kafasi, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's Deputy Director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.